It's generally understood that a blues performer sings or plays to rid himself of the blues. This is so important to blues musicians that many maintain one cannot play the music unless one has a blue feeling or feels blue. Maybe no other form of music is so closely tied to the emotion of the performer as the blues. Where did the blues come from, and what makes the blues different from any other kind of music? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Emotion aside, what are the musical hallmarks of the blues? Who were the practitioners that brought the blues into the musical mainstream? And as musical types continue to blend, what's becoming of the blues? For that matter, is there such a thing as happy blues? Our guest with the answers, some of them at least, is Howard Stith, a.k.a. Poor Howard Stith, who during the past 30 years has performed the blues throughout the U.S., Europe, and Japan, and hails now from Dover, New Hampshire.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with that question that Norman mentioned. Where do the blues come from?
Clarksdale, Mississippi. No. That's the simplified answer.
What day of the week?
Yes. Well, the roots of the blues actually stretch all the way back into the slave era. And you were talking about singing the blues to get out of the blues. And that's a lot of the music really is fashioned that way. We think of blues as being slow, sad music. And you're actually going to be hard-pressed to find very many songs that fall into that category. Most of the old blues songs, like I do, from pre-1940, are very up-tempo. And it's more to get you out of the feeling of your environment rather than getting deeper into the depression. I did encounter an anthropologist back in 1838 who had lived on a plantation for a year, who wrote that most of the music done by the slaves was up-tempo because the masters of the plantation actually forbade the more depressing songs because it inhibited the work ethic. And that seems to have just carried on through the gospel music and into the blues. I don't remember if it was Son House, one of the blues men once said, the difference between gospel music and blues is you take out God and you put in my baby, and it's the same song.
I also like the definition that Langston Hughes gives when he's writing about the blues, and he talks about in the blues, behind the sadness, there is almost always laughter and strength. Yeah. Something about that bittersweet thing where it's survival, it's overcoming adversity, too.
It really is. And, yeah, I went through some rough times a number of years back when I first started getting into blues. So I probably had more of a qualification to sing it then than I do these days because things have been going much better in recent years.
Well, that's unfortunate. We'll just have to hope that things take a turn for the worse for you, Howard. What about the instrumentation, if we go back to the beginning? We think, you talk about plantations post-Civil War, those years. You think of the banjo, but that's another fast-playing instrument usually.
Actually, the banjo is originally an African instrument. So I don't play blues banjo myself, although I have friends. Sparky Rucker plays banjo. He's a great proponent of the early blues. And a lot of the early songs came from the field hollers. Give you a quick one of those. It was one that I picked up from the Singing of Lead Bellies. Julianne Johnson. It's a song you'd sing while you were hoeing the weeds. Julianne Johnson, oh my, Julianne Johnson, oh my, look out, Julie, oh my, look out, Julie, oh my, talk to me now, oh my, talk to me now, oh my, look out, Julie, oh my, look out, Julie, oh my, Julianne Johnson, oh my, Julianne Johnson, oh my. And now we could just continue and ad lib verses onto that.
And what makes it the blues? It doesn't have that 12-bar pattern with the repeated first line that we think of. What makes it the blues?
Blues can actually, we get stuck into 12-bar blues. That's almost a Chicago convention. There's 12-bar blues, there's 8-bar blues, 16-bar blues. We joke about Mississippi Fred McDowell doing 17-bar blues because he has very odd syncopated patterns to his music and guitar work. But the Field Hollers, the work songs, became the basis of the early blues songs. You'll find those in prison chain gang songs, too, if you've ever seen the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes.
I was surprised how little attention I was paying to that, the opening of that movie, because one of the songs on a recent CD is the song Poor Lazarus, which I do on slide guitar. And it was originally a chain gang song. Well, they open the movie with that song being sung by the chain gang. And it keeps the rhythm so that all of the hammers are falling at the same time. And then that set the rhythm pattern, which then went into the blues.
So is that the kind of thing with that sort of heavy accented beat and the kind of off-kilter timing? Is that the kind of thing you can actually play on a guitar? Does it work that way?
You can't. In fact, I'm in the wrong tuning for that song, or I would just give you a brief example of that one. Yeah, let's see.
And what you got there?
This is an old 1930 National steel guitar. Being played with a bottleneck, hence the name Bottleneck Blues.
And that literally is a bottleneck on your little finger.
It is.
And you've got a shiny silver guitar here.
Yeah, this was a guitar that was popular among the blues singers during the 30s because it was very loud. And you could get above the sound of the piano, which was one of the prominent instruments in the barrel houses where they'd go out drinking. Always have a piano player, and then the guitar player would fill in, and he'd get lost behind the piano and or the banjo. So he came up with the steel guitar, which was amplified a little bit more. And
where did the slide come from? Where did that idea come out?
That actually also goes back to some of the early African music, because the African tonal scale is different from the Western scale, and there are notes that don't exist. And with the slide, instead of going from here to here, you go from here to there.
Right. The shade in between.
And the bottleneck on your finger, tell me what that's for. To be able to do that.
Uh-huh. And then you can actually use that to... You can match the voice. Although I was matching incorrectly there.
You get that blues notes, the sort of quarter tones.
It gets in between the standard notes.
And is a slide something you would use with a 12-string too?
I do, but not that often because it's a pain to retune the 12-string. There are some shows where I'll have four guitars so I can keep one in four different tunings and do some 12-string slide, which is quite interesting, actually. Barbecue Bob was a terrific 12-string player who played all slide guitar. We had a song called the Mississippi Heavy Water Blues about the Great Flood of 1927 that just a marvelous piece of music.
Well, is there a sample you can give us of something that you feel is just meant for this steel guitar?
Sure. I was talking about blues originating in Clarksdale, Mississippi. One of my favorite songs, because it sort of hits close to home, is one called Highway 61. Back during the 20s and 30s, the blues players from Clarksdale and Leland, Mississippi, would travel north on Highway 61 to get to Memphis and on to St. Louis and Chicago. So it was kind of an important road. I was living in St. Paul, Minnesota at the time, and 61 runs through there, but I was always a little perverse, so I traveled south instead of north. It's still a lonesome road. two slow ones. This 61 highway is the longest road I know. Yes, this 61 highway is the longest road I know. She runs from way up in Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. I started to school one morning, but I threw my books down by the way. I started to school one morning, threw my books down by the way. Not a recommended thing to do, by the way. I wrote a letter to my teacher, said, believe I'll try old 61 today. Cry, Lord, if I should die now before you think my time has come. Yes, if I should die now before you think my time has come. Want you to bury my body right by old Highway 61. Let's go down on Highway 61.
Nice bluesy chord to wrap it all up. It seems as if E is a particularly promising key for blues. You get that kind of, what is it, because the lowness of it, and you get to kind of build up from there? What is it about
it
that
is.
Key?
Oddly enough, I only do a handful of songs in E myself, more G, A, and D.
Really? Uh-huh. Now, we've all heard the term Delta blues, and is that pretty much the oldest kind of recognized form of the blues?
Well, there are two distinct styles of blues from the older styles. One is the Delta blues, which comes from primarily Mississippi, Louisiana, from Memphis south. It was a rural blues. It traveled south, became Dixieland jazz, traveled north, became rock and roll, Chicago blues, and then into jazz as well. on the East Coast between Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, Georgia, they had what they call the Piedmont blues. The biggest difference in the style is the thumb work. Delta blues is a straight beat. And the Piedmont blues is more of a... let's see. It's an alternating picking. You find a lot of the Piedmont blues is more of a ragtime sound. Like.
Oh.
So someone like W.C. Handy, which of those?
Well, he didn't really do the country blues. The Memphis blues that he did was more of the bands. Alberta Hunter, who was one of the Paramount artists that they brought north to Grafton to record. May remember Trouble in Mind. That was one of her songs. Memphis Minnie. Did more closer to the country blues style, but it was a little more sophisticated.
Well, tell me about this 12-string guitar that you just switched to. When does it come on the scenes?
Very early. Early 1900s. Actually, earlier than that. They were being built as early as 1880 and became popular in Atlanta, a little bit in Cincinnati, and a little bit in Louisiana. I haven't had the opportunity to really catalog how widespread the instrument was. Huddy Leadbetter, also known as Leadbelly, referred to himself as the king of the 12-string guitar players when he was in Louisiana, partly because I think he had one of the only ones around. So it's easy to be king if you're alone.
Small kingdom.
And you go to Atlanta, you find Barbecue Bob, Blind Willie McTell, who did, you know, the more of the very light, delicate guitar work. Leadbelly was accused of having a drum inside his guitar because of the way he would beat on it and have that steady backbeat there.
Can you give us a sample on your 12-string guitar?
I could. I'll do one of Leadbelly's songs here. I like this one because it's a song that everybody knows, but not quite. It's called Down in New Orleans. Popular in the 60s in a different form. Way down in New Orleans, house called the Rising Sun. Spend the ruin of many a poor boy and me, oh God, I mourn. Yes, way down in New Orleans, house called the Rising Sun. Spend the ruin of many a poor boy and me, oh God, I mourn.
That's very different than the House of the Rising Sun.
That was the 1938 arrangement.
Considerably different from what the Animals did.
Yes.
More on the blues when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Howard Stith, also known as Poor Howard Stith, who is a historian of the blues and a practitioner of them as well. And we're looking primarily at the Delta Blues and the Piedmont Blues. It all had to change pretty quickly, didn't it, once recording came along and you could hear what other guys were doing and kind of pick up on it?
Yes and no. There are definitely a lot of songs that were copied by various performers. There's a song called The Walkin' Blues that for years was attributed to Robert Johnson, and mm-hmm. then it came to light that, no, Robert Johnson actually learned it from Sun House.
And Sun House Records.
Pardon?
Or for Sun House, a recording made by him.
And there was a lot of mixing and matching where you'd get the same song with a different title or one verse changed. Uh-huh. And it's a practice that I think still continues quite a bit.
When you perform a song, how much do you sort of put your own take on it?
Most of the songs I do an arrangement of rather than copying it identically. Some songs just can't be improved upon. So.
Give me an example. Can you give us a sample of one where you just have to do it the way it has been done?
I could think of a couple. One is Leadbelly's song about New York City. The first time he went to New York City, he was impressed by it, so he wrote a song about it. And I think this is one of the most beautiful guitar riffs I've ever encountered. And I only know one other person who does this song. It's a blues player from Hamburg, Germany, by the name of Abby Wallenstein that I met 40-some years ago. I was delighted to find out he was playing it. So it's New York City Blues. Get to New York City, let me tell you what to do. Get up on a bus and ride up Fifth Avenue in New York City. Ain't that a city? New York City, Lord, I gotta know my line. Now you walk outside and it looks like rain. Get up on board that subway train in New York City. Ooh, ain't that a city? New York City, Lord, I got to know my line. Now the trains keep running and they won't stand still. I'm gonna take a train out to Sugar Hill in New York City. Ooh, ain't that a city? New York City, Lord, I got to know my line. Let's go down to New York City. Tell everybody about the state of New York and New York City. Ain't that a city? New York City, Lord, I got to know my line. I get down to New Orleans, you know I'll tell about that railroad that they call the L in New York City. Ooh, ain't that a city? New York City, Lord, I got to know my line. Yes, New York City, got to know my line. New York City, I'll be hard to find. New York City, ain't that a city? New York City, Lord, I got to know my line. Let's go back to New York City one more time. Yes. That beautiful three-octave run. It's just like, yes.
What record labels were actually recording into these early Delta Blues artists, and who was buying the records?
Well, Paramount Records, which was part of the Wisconsin Chair Factory in Grafton, that was one of the local connections. I think they ran from 1915 to 1935, or 34, 35 when they closed up. Wisconsin Chair Factory started making phonograph cases and then went one step farther and started making phonograph records. In 1922, they picked up Alberta Hunter to do blues, which is more of the Bessie Smith style, the big band blues. And then in 1926, they picked up Charlie Patton and Blind Arthur Blake, two different, totally different styles of music. Charlie Patton was considered the king of the Delta blues. Blind Blake did Piedmont blues, very intricate, delicate style. Sun House also recorded for Paramount. Bluebird Records was a another label. Bluebird and OK.
Oh, yeah, O-K-E-H.
Yeah, O-K-E-H. Was another label. That was the one that Leadbelly recorded a lot of things on. RCA Victor was part of the Bluebird. I think that they were, Bluebird was a subsidiary of Victor. Talk, Mr. Lips. But Paramount was actually a very important, played an important role in what they called their race records. That turned out to be a large market in the music at the time. And that was when performers would buy the records of other performers and say, hey, I can do that song too. And it gets very cloudy as to who owned the copyrights on some of those early songs. Of course, Lightning Hopkins was famous for going to New York to record and did sort of the Woody Guthrie thing, go to the recording studio, sell them their five songs for $25 and go down the street and do the same songs for the next company.
Well, for
$25,
you know you got to get a little more than that out of it.
Although that Signs of the Times, that even Paramount, they'd bring performers north from Mississippi, give them bus fare, pay them $20 for 14 sides, and bus ticket home. And that's the last some of the performers ever knew about the music until...
And suddenly somebody making some money on it somewhere. Yeah. Robert Johnson is one of those interesting cases, isn't he? Did he record virtually everything that we have of his in that, like, one hotel room session?
Pretty much, yeah.
And he did not live very long either.
No, there's... The circumstances surrounding his death are a little bit cloudy, but it's pretty much accepted that he was killed by either a jealous girlfriend or a jealous boyfriend and was poisoned in, I think it was 1932 or 34.
So probably all of his recordings you could get on, what, one or two CDs?
That's basically it. Yeah. There is a two CD set that's the complete works of Robert Johnson. As far as we know, that's actually true.
He comes up as a character in Sherman Alexie's Reservation Blues. Now, I think there's a lot of legend that goes with blues singers and performers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's
tall tales and anecdotes.
That, and of course, there's the whole mystique surrounding the black magic and the superstitions of the South. I mean, you will see that. You know, there was the legend that Robert Johnson went to the crossroads, probably of Highway 61 and 49, and sold his soul to the devil. I tried selling my soul to the devil. I learned how to tune a banjo. He wasn't interested. So,
not even $25, huh?
Years ago, I made a pilgrimage to Leadbelly's grave down in Mooringsport, Louisiana. One of the things that struck me is that his was the only grave. It was a small country churchyard out in the swamp. Had a hard time even finding the site at the time. And that was even asking the people in the local post office. They had no clue where Shiloh Baptist Church was in Mooringsport. But I finally found it. And Leadbelly's grave had a granite tombstone. That was the only grave in the cemetery that did. I mean, there was so much poverty that nothing has changed there. Most of the graves were marked with pieces of shingle that just had the names and the dates painted on, and a lot of them would fade off. But what struck me was the number of graves that would have crosses created from old light bulbs on top of the grave. And it took me a while to really comprehend it. I said, well, duh, it's the light of the world. Uh-huh. You know, Jesus is the light of the world. I said, that would carry over. It's symbolic. So you use a light.
We hope at least 60 watts.
Yeah. But it was the symbolism there was there, and it suddenly made sense.
Mm-hmm. There's a Ralph Ellison quote where he talks about, as a form, the blues is an autobiographical chronicle of personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. And I like that, the idea of taking catastrophe and expressing it lyrically. In all the blues songs that you've been performing, what are some of the catastrophes that, you know, there you are strumming away and singing and getting applause, but there's pain and real catastrophe and suffering at the heart of it, right?
There is. Actually, I need to retune this guitar, if I could take a second to do that. We'll go back to Barbecue Bob. I was mentioning him earlier. Let's see.
Have you ever written a tuning blues?
There are some songs, I don't know how many blues songs, but in which the performer actually retunes the guitar as he's playing. That's kind of a fun thing to see. I mean, not
the shortest shortest audition I ever did for a gig one time at a coffee house out east was, I had the 12-string guitar in an open G tuning and proceeded to do Foggy Mountain Breakdown, Foggy Mountain Chimes, and did the Scruggs retuning on the 12-string, and the booker's jaw drops and you're hired. I don't think I could even do it again. This is a song that Barbecue Bob wrote about the Great Flood of 1927. There are actually a number of songs about that. Bessie Smith's Backwater Blues was about that. John Estes, Sleepy John Estes, wrote a song called The Floating Bridge. It was about a bridge that got washed out when people were trying to get across to escape the flood, and the whole bridge got washed away with the people on it and everyone drowned. This is from 1927, the Mississippi Heavy Water Blues. Thank you.
personal catastrophe expressed lyrically.
Were the blues getting a fair amount of radio play as we get into the 30s?
I really don't think I can answer that one honestly. The fact that the records were popular, but I think there was more of the direct sales than radio airplay at the time. Although a lot of the blues songs then got picked up and became incorporated into the string band music as well.
Wondering about the
black
ensemble.
And white cultures did have some crossover in the music styles.
Was there a sheet music market for the blues? It seems to me that the something almost something missing between the lines. If you just write it down,
there was sheet music available for some of the early blues done by the bands. Louis Armstrong, Alberta Hunter, Bessie Smith, and those are collector's items now. To get that sheet music, not as much so for the country blues. I think they realized they were catering to a clientele that probably didn't read music but played by ear.
Oh, well, that's true too. Yeah, and it just seems to be such an individualized thing that it would be hard to, convey it in sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems you'd lose some of the immediacy if you're reading music as opposed to kind of improvising some of it.
So what are the sort of the big components of the language of the blues? I mean, we have, flatted sevenths and that kind of thing, and not to mention the rhythms.
Actually, Mississippi Heavy Water Blues, backtracking just a minute, is a good example of the difference between the Piedmont and Delta, because that was the Atlanta alternating picking style compared to just the straight beat. And the other thing with the Piedmont blues, it was pretty much you'd have your bass string open. In a lot of the Delta blues, they would mute the bass string so that it was more like a drum in the background. And that was your dance beat. Components of the blues, subject matter, farming. You find songs like, how much I hate to walk behind a mule all day with that plow. A lot of traveling songs and train songs, trying to get across the horizon to someplace a little bit better. In Robert Johnson's song, Sweet Home Chicago, he talks about going to Chicago, back to that land of California, Sweet Home Chicago. California wasn't so much a real place as almost a mythical.
The promised land.
That was it. Somewhere else. So California was an idea rather than a state in some of the early blues songs.
What about love and its loss?
Oh, yeah, you find a lot of that. I've even written songs like that. Actually, I shy away from that. I wrote a song for my first wife's lawyer. I didn't write it about her. Whoever said talk is cheap never had a lawyer do the talking.
So if you were to pick your, at this moment, not necessarily tomorrow or yesterday, but your favorite blues composer, let's say, who would it be?
Leadbelly is still way up there. The first song I ever learned when I was, probably 5-6 years old, it was the first song I remember learning and memorizing, was Goodnight Irene, done by Leadbelly on 12-string guitar, and I think that's what directed me years later to pick up the 12-string.
Now, it's interesting because that original version, Goodnight Irene, isn't a blues song.
The original version, we don't know. That went back to about 1880. That's a song that was reworked, sort of like Down in New Orleans versus House of the Rising Sun. The song has been reworked by many people, but it was Leadbelly's signature piece. He also wrote a song called The Bourgeois Blues. He was very much an activist, political activist in his time, on almost a covert, semi-subversive level. Writing songs about Jim Crow, and wrote a song about the Scottsboro Boys after the boys were accused of rape. Turned out they were all innocent, but they went to prison anyway.
Yeah, big political cause. Are the blues artists at this point, I mean, if we're talking all the way up into, say, the early 30s, are they all black?
Yeah, pretty much. It didn't really become a crossover music really until probably in the 60s with the revival, when the British rock musicians started going back to those roots. And the Europeans are much more attuned to American blues than almost anybody I've ever met here.
They were quick to pick up on jazz, too.
I know a guy in Hanover, Germany, who put together complete discographies. Now, look at it, I said, I didn't know that record existed. And I said, how did he find this?
Let's see if we can get in a few more songs when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Howard is a traveling minstrel in the classical sense, with a working repertoire of around 500 songs and a large selection of regional humor gathered while on the road. He was not only a crowd pleaser, but a curiosity, someone you'd want to sit down with over a cup of coffee. That's from a review in a Minnesota paper. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Poor Howard Stith, blues artist. I have to ask you about your name. Why Poor Howard?
I was actually tagged with that by another musician. One of Leadbelly's songs was Poor Howard, about a blind fiddler from the 1800s who performed all the sooky dances. Poor Howard's dead and gone. And because I was doing more Leadbelly 40 years ago than I'm even doing now, I think, a friend in Minneapolis tagged me with the name. It was Papa John Kolstad. I have my vengeance. I tagged him with the name Papa John, and neither of us have been able to shake those monikers in 40 years. So
what's a Leadbelly song that you regularly perform still?
Well, since we were just talking about the political activism they had in his commentary of life in the times, when John Lomax took Huddy Leadbetter to Washington, D.C., it was still, the Jim Crow laws were very much in effect in Washington, D.C., so Leadbelly couldn't stay in the white hotels with John Lomax. Lomax couldn't stay in the black hotels. And they had an interesting time, you know, connecting up every day to get together, and prompted Leadbelly to comment that he thought that Washington, D.C. was a bourgeois town. He fell in love with that word. It's a bourgeois town. And I'm actually not sure that much has changed in Washington since 1940, but... This is the bourgeois blues.
Come on, you people, listen to me. Don't ever try to find a home in Washington, D.C. It's a bourgeois town. Honey, it's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues. I'm sure going to spread the news. Me and Martha walked all over town. Everywhere we go, people would turn us down. It's a bourgeois town. Honey, it's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues. Sure gonna spread the news. People in Washington, they know how to toss a man a nickel just to watch him bow. It's a bourgeois town. Honey, it's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues. I'm sure gonna spread the news. Home of the brave, land of the free. Don't want to bow to no bourgeoisie. It's a bourgeois town. Honey, it's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues. I'm sure gonna spread the news. So I say, come all you people, listen to me. Don't ever try to find a home in Washington, D.C. It's a bourgeois town. honey, it's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, I'm sure gonna spread the news. Yes.
You said that you started, you know, hearing blues early, like age 5 or something like that, and I assume you started playing them early too. How have you seen attitudes toward the blues change over your lifetime of playing them?
A little bit, although I really didn't start playing until the mid-60s. You know, it was during the folk revival and then the blues revival, and all of a sudden my ears perked up. I said, that sounds like an interesting music. And that was really when I started getting into it. It was 64, 65. And blues wasn't all that common at the time, but was just beginning to pick up because people like the Rolling Stones.
Well, even the Kingston Trio, you know, was doing a little bit of that filtered into their folk music.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and the Rooftop Singers did Walk Right In.
Yeah,
it was an old Gus
sure.
Cannon Jug Band uh-huh. song. Another
Very
one
bluesy.
Recorded from Paramount Records in Grafton, in
uh-huh.
fact.
Was it?
Gus Cannon
mm-hmm.
was up here. So.
And do you find now, if you say, I'm a blues artist, how do people respond?
That will vary all over the country because some people say, oh, wow, blues, great. And people say, like, what's that?
So is it still, you think, the heartland for blues is still, you know, in the Delta and the Piedmont, or is it still a thing of those places?
It's become much more universal. I had the privilege of representing New Hampshire in the International Blues Challenge this year down in Memphis. Actually spent, because we kept running into each other, I spent most of the week sharing a table with the competitor from Tokyo and one from Croatia, from Split Croatia. And blues is just big. Second place in the solo duo division went to a duo from Barcelona, Spain. And we're dead ringers for Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee.
It's really a universal genre.
It really is.
It's
fascinating. It is just a worldwide music now.
I would imagine the Russians would be good at it, too. They've got this
I don't know.
Tradition of sad songs.
But see, these aren't that sad.
But again, that's right. It's a song to get you out of it. What's another must-have song?
Well, since we were talking about Paramount Records in Grafton and Sun House, I should do one of Sun House's songs here. We were talking about traveling and rambling. I've got rambling on my mind. This is a song from Sun called The Walkin' Blues. Well, I woke up this morning, felt around for my shoes. You know by that I've got these walking blues. Woke up this morning, felt around for my shoes. You know by that I've got these walking blues. I feel like blowing my own lonesome horn. I looked around and all I had was gone. Feel like blowing. This morning, if I have to ride the blinds, I'm so mistreated now I don't mind dying. Leaving this morning, if I have to ride the blinds, I'm so mistreated, Lord, and I don't mind dying. Let's go. Mm-hmm.
ain't bad, but it's the meanest feeling now I've ever had. Some folks say these weary blues ain't bad, but it's the meanest feeling, Lord, that I've ever had. 'Cause I woke up this morning, felt around for my shoes. You know by that I've got these walking blues. Woke up this morning, I felt around for my shoes. You know by that I've got these walking blues.
Now, why do you use, personally, a cutoff date of 1940 for your repertory?
That's a random figure because I actually do some songs from Piano Red Perryman. They're written in the late 40s and early 50s. But basically, the style of most of the songs that I do are considered pre-war blues because after the Second World War, the music did start to change, and then that led into the doo-wop music and the rhythm and blues, which then became rock and roll. And it was a subtle change at first, but there is definitely a difference in the style of music after 1945.
Become too slick, too commercial?
No, it was just stylized differences and more of the harmonies. You'd have the small groups. Like the Coasters, who did just really incredible stuff. And
so what speaks to you most about the blues you do play?
What speaks most? Well, partly it's just the history that's involved there and trying to keep it alive a little bit. The poetry of the blues is a little different from what you find in other poetry, but it's an art form that is just as valid. Some of the blues metaphors, most of which I wouldn't use on the air, were incredibly well done. There was one performer, and I just blanked his name. And I said that was Sam Chapman's brother. I can't remember what he sang under it. He had some of the most off-color songs you could find, but they were couched in metaphors, so he got them past the censors, and they got radio airplay.
Yeah, I am surprised at some of the things that got through, you know, that you can hear recordings of today.
Yeah, and it's because there was that disconnect between the white and black cultures, so the producers would listen to it and say, oh, yeah, that's an interesting song, but didn't catch the underlying translation of the lyrics.
But a lot of fun to listen to and a lot of fun to have
absolutely
you here playing them for us. Our guest today has been Howard Stith, also known as Poor Howard Stith, which does not refer at all to the playing, but just to sometimes the lifestyle, I guess, that goes with the blues. The great pleasure to have you all the way from Dover, New Hampshire, to join us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be back in Madison. Thank you for having me in today.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.